Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we'll continue our explorations of the cultures of consciousness. I've been thinking a lot lately about the increasingly mainstream presence of psychedelics and psychedelic research in our world, and it's really quite striking how rapidly things and attitudes are changing. I think one of the reasons, and on top of just the fact that lots of people have been interested in doing this research and have been willing to do the work, and there have been enough people to gather up the cash to make it possible, that the shifts in marijuana have really, I think, changed people's minds in a way that, with cannabis legalization and decriminalization movements and the increasing acceptance of their role in people's healing, and frankly, just as another component of people's enjoyment, there's a sort of, this kind of cognitive shift where suddenly this compound that had always been a quote-unquote drug is now seen as a, something whose meaning is kind of up for grabs and indeed is changing rapidly. And sort of the kind of conclusion you come from that is like, well, maybe they're all like this. Maybe every single compound has its own story, its own place, and to just think of this category of illegal drugs as being set and settled is clearly no longer the case. And I think that psychedelic research has partly benefited from that. And I think another thing is the increasing scientific data about meditation, because while meditation on the surface maybe has not so much directly to do with psychedelics, they're linked culturally, because meditation became a really important part of American spiritual exploration, around the same time that people were starting to really use psychedelics for personal growth and exploration of consciousness. And then a lot of the material from the 70s, 60s, 70s, 80s, when people were talking about meditation, they were also talking about it in the context where people were exploring altered states or different states of consciousness. In a way, even the phrase altered states, which is a relic of that era, doesn't quite make it, because it sounds like there's some true state that then we're altering in some way, so there's something kind of bizarre or transient about these other states of consciousness. But I think that as people see that the proof is definitely there that meditation makes a huge difference to the brain, to stress, to healing, and in addition to that, clearly has these more intangible spiritual or psycho-spiritual effects, at least for a lot of people who explore it. And I think that, too, has opened up a space where other sort of techniques of altering consciousness become kind of available as potentially, at the very least, useful, if not also interesting and possibly illuminating. So we'll be continuing to talk about these things today, because we have someone who has studied scientifically both meditation and psychedelics in terms of their effects on people, their healing effects, the psychology involved. And we'll be talking with Catherine McLean, who worked at Johns Hopkins for a while doing some of their, or being involved in some of their really cutting-edge experiments in psychedelics, with psilocybin and also Salvia Divinorum, and she's also gone on a really interesting journey of her own that reminds us always that these questions often open up deeper dimensions that exceed the professional frameworks of action studies and publishing. So I look forward to that very much. Before we bring Catherine on, of course, we'll ask our co-host to join us. Maja Dau, how you doing?
Hi, Eric. I'm good. You know, I just want to sneak in a little mini rant about this subject.
Please do.
Because you brought up so many important points. And to me, here's the question we need to ask. we, as a human scientific society, explore the health and human results of radioactivity. Radioactivity, a substance that we know for certain if we eat we'll die. Okay, we think that's cool to investigate medicinally and scientifically. However, we refuse to investigate certain plants that, like you said, are drugs. And I think people just need to ask, is it because they are dangerous? And if the answer to that is yes, then we should not be investigating radioactivity. So just on a sheer logical mind frame, you have to understand that there's more involved in the situation than the chemicals or what's happening. So just on a basic level of investigating scientifically what these things do, what they're capable of, I don't understand why that should be different than any other substance, from gold to whatever, that we investigate unabashedly, always. So I can't state the importance and my agreement with you on how no matter what we find out with these plants or substances or psychedelics, anything with those properties, they absolutely must be investigated like everything else to our greatest capacity.
Yeah, it's very true. And the fact that that hasn't been the case, tells you a lot about how science actually works, in
totally.
The society
at
large, that of course many decisions are not made based on quote unquote pure science, but on all sorts of political, cultural, in some cases even religious, ideas. So,
totally.
So it's a fascinating topic to study, and I'm really glad that Catherine's going to join us. So Catherine, welcome to Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric and Maja. It's wonderful to join you. I am looking out at a whole lot of snow here in Connecticut. I don't know what you guys are experiencing now, but it's definitely a winter wonderland here in the Northeast.
That's pretty. It's all blue skies in California over here. I don't know about you down there, Maja.
Oh, it's totally raining here right now.
So we have slices of it all. So, Catherine, I thought one place it might be nice to start is just to tell us a little bit more about what you actually did for these various studies at Johns Hopkins. If I understand it right, it involved both some science and some things that are a little bit more almost like psychotherapy or at least sort of psychological acts or performances with the various people who are involved in the studies.
Yeah, so I'll give you a little bit of kind of how I found my way to psychedelic science. You were talking about how the advances have actually been really rapid, almost exponential in the last few years, in terms of the science that's coming out, the number of groups doing the research, and the public support, which has been overwhelmingly positive. I've been really kind of pleasantly surprised to see most media reports and most people I've spoken to about our research actually be pretty supportive. And I don't think most of those folks are just being polite when I talk about the really cool findings that we're seeing with psilocybin. But back in 2000, when I first learned that there was this, plant called ayahuasca that shamans used in South America, and I was also learning about the brain, I kind of thought, this is exactly what I'm going to do. I'm going to study the effects of psychedelics on spirituality and understand it from a neuroscience perspective. And at the time, nothing was happening in that whole arena, and people basically said, it's over, it's done. Leary kind of ruined it for everybody, the typical propaganda, and you can't do it. So you better focus on something more, mainstream. And I went as far outside the mainstream as I could at the time, which was meditation. And over the last 10 years or so, through grad school, through my time at Hopkins, both meditation and psychedelics have all of a sudden become a lot more mainstream. So that was a really cool path for me to follow, first through the meditation piece and then finding myself at Hopkins. The work that I focused on at Hopkins was mainly with psilocybin, and I'll just kind of give a quick window into the main studies that are going on right now or just completed. The one that I was involved in was healthy, normal volunteers who were interested in starting a spiritual practice involving daily meditation and developing kind of better awareness in their daily life. And those folks got a certain amount of psilocybin, either early on in the study or kind of once their 6 months of meditation practice had been completed. And we looked at changes in all sorts of domains related to emotion, psychology, spirituality, relationships, general well-being. But these were all healthy people to begin with. So that was the major focus when the last basically 4 years that I was at Hopkins. Alongside of that, we had a really important study going on with people who had a cancer diagnosis, who had pretty serious depression or anxiety around their diagnosis, and for whom they hadn't, you know, these people hadn't really found any real benefit from traditional therapy. And for anyone who's kind of seen someone go through the journey of cancer, the whole psycho-spiritual piece is often left out for a lot of patients. And so that study is ongoing. It's just about to be completed. And we'll get to see if the psilocybin plus the psychotherapy help these cancer patients reduce their depression, anxiety, and stress related to having cancer. And then,
let's go back to the first study. Just while it's still in my mind, I'm just curious if you could, you know, even generally like summarize or give your own spin on what exactly the relationship between meditation and, in this case, psilocybin experiences seem to be. Like how would you sort of characterize their relationship in these people's lives as part of their commitment to developing a more spiritual life?
Yeah, I think the easy kind of part to this is the meditation. I've seen over and over and over again very simple 10-minute-a-day practice of basically any kind of meditation people try, whether it's classic Buddhist practices, focusing on the breath, the mindfulness meditation that a lot of people have heard of, or this particular type that we taught people, which was just repeating a passage, literally a written passage that you memorize and repeat to yourself over and over. Anything that can kind of anchor the mind for 10 minutes a day really helps people feel more centered, calm. It gives them a little bit more space when they're kind of dealing with crisis situations, which could be the minor trauma and crisis of everyday life, you know, being stuck in traffic, having to meet deadlines, or it could be a major crisis, like someone becoming ill in your family, or some of our volunteers were dealing with pretty difficult family situations of children, you know, having difficult times in high school, or a spouse having, you know, problems with drinking, or kind of, you know, just the whole range of middle America, you know, normal type things that we all go through. And what I saw over the course of 6 months is initially meditation is really hard, and people usually don't want to do it. It's like starting a running exercise or like, you know, doing anything new. You have to do it for a few weeks before you even stop hating it, and then it becomes a habit. And then after that, you know, it really starts to kind of weave into your life as something that you look forward to. So that's the meditation piece. Meditation is kind of mostly benefit and just a little bit of risk. And I'll talk about the risk in a second, but the meditation piece is easy. And so what did the psilocybin add? From my perspective, what the psilocybin added was a much broader kind of spiritual, or you could use the word cosmic. For some people who are very strong atheists, it could be just a larger intellectual framework for, you know, kind of why am I even meditating and what's the purpose and what am I trying to get out of my life? And what we found is that people who got the higher dose of psilocybin early on in the study seemed to have a kind of bigger backdrop that helped motivate them to practice meditation. And so when the meditation became something that wasn't that fun or was boring or was a pain in the ass and you didn't want to do it that morning, the psilocybin session kind of was a little bit of extra fuel. And in good and bad ways, in good ways kind of saying, yeah, I kind of get the bigger picture. I got a glimpse. I know why I'm doing this every morning. And kind of on the bad side, it was maybe introducing a lot more questions than people kind of knew that there were questions to ask before they entered the study. And so that kind of questioning in classic, at least in Buddhist meditation, that questioning and that fuel to understand and know more keeps people kind of on the meditation path.
So wait, so for the questioning, it's like people, you felt like people, like they were thrust too deeply into the questioning?
Yeah, you know, sometimes I think we've seen all sorts of different trajectories. Sometimes people, when we prepare volunteers for psilocybin, we share with them everything that we have seen before and what has been reported for psychedelics. And we always say, this is kind of the general territory. It could be ecstatic. It could be boring. It could be really scary. You might feel like you're dying. But we don't want to know what it's going to be like for you. And we've actually seen kind of all of those different types of reactions. So some people get a pretty easy, wonderful first exposure to psilocybin. The high dose, the highest dose that we've used at Hopkins is 30 milligrams synthetic psilocybin, which is equivalent to about 5 or 6 dried grams of mushroom. And for most of the volunteers, this was the first time they'd ever taken anything like a psychedelic or even any drug. So this is a pretty hefty dose, and some people just seem to kind of get the golden ticket, and they have a beautiful, sublime, mystical experience that is generally very positive. And the integration from that is usually pretty easy, because you kind of are left feeling like you're completely supported and off you go into the world. We've also seen people have really difficult and terrifying experiences that kind of can go two different ways. One way is it takes a little while, months, maybe even years to integrate, but then you finally look back on it and say, wow, that was a real growth experience. Or sometimes people come out of that feeling very empowered, like, hey, I just went through hell, and now everyday life, like, I can do this. This is simple. So depending on, you know, if it's too much of the kind of cosmic bliss and it seems too far away from ordinary reality, or on the kind of more bad trip, I hate to use that term, but it's a term that people recognize, on that kind of the bad trip end of the spectrum, both of those things actually have brought up questions for volunteers that they kind of didn't even know how big the territory was, and then they're like, oh, now I get it. It's actually way bigger than I thought before I signed up for this study.
Right. So not just the fact that the experience itself was grueling, but that it leaves in its wake some large existential cosmic questions that you know, in our daily lives we're not really very often called upon to ask, and then you're sitting there going, oh, great, now I have this to deal with too.
Right. And, you know, built into the study were some of the people, about a third of the volunteers, were randomly assigned to a high support group, and they came in every week and either met with us individually, either one or two of the people who, the study staff who were in the room with the person during the whole experience, or they would meet with groups of other volunteers who just had a psilocybin session. And we wanted to see if that support kind of improved the outcomes for people who got the support. And I think anecdotally the support was really helpful, but the funny thing is over the course of 6 months, I think it's long enough for even people who don't have a huge amount of social support, 6 months is kind of a long enough time for even people without, who are kind of on their own, to really integrate their experience. And so by the end of the study, we didn't see much differences in people who'd either gotten the support or didn't. Mm. But what did seem to matter a lot was whether you got a high-dose psilocybin session at the beginning of the study.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
That can make sense. I mean, it seems like it's, I mean, when you think about what's similar about meditation and psychedelics, there's a lot of real differences, and it's real tricky territory, but obviously it seems like some in more drastic ways, sometimes in less drastic ways. It really is just a step outside of the normal ego, and the ego's capable of like reasserting itself even in very peculiar circumstances. So even if you're, you know, reasonably altered in some kind of other world, you know, you can be, oh yeah, I'm here too, this is mine, okay, this is, you know, you're still kind of operating in this way, but in a high dose experience, and I think even just the simple discipline of every day doing something that you don't necessarily want to do, kind of like the way you do, you do workouts or whatever, but in both those situations, you're called on, you can't help but go outside your range, and that itself, is a really powerful thing, even if later on you kind of incorporate it more into your life or even into your ego, just being pulled out that way. So I could see that the difference between a significant dose and a mild one would be strong. So what kinds of things are you finding with the cancer patients and the end-of-life issues, which are obviously a lot heavier than the kind of more day-to-day problems you mentioned earlier?
Yeah. I haven't had as much of an opportunity to work within the cancer project, but I can say that what I've seen, and this maybe is a more powerful testament to the psilocybin and the therapy working, is I will see a person come in the door for screening, and we do really kind of careful and conservative screening for psychiatric history, either in the volunteer or their family. Just ruling out major risk factors that are believed to interact in not such a great way with psychedelics. So people come in for the screening process, and you will see someone who's very withdrawn, classically depressed, or on the other end of the spectrum, almost so agitated with anxiety that they can barely hold their seat, and you can see the kind of the worry just coming out even in their their normal interactions with the study staff. And then I've seen that same person come in the day after a high dose session, and it's like it's them, but it's them just kind of with the edges smooth. And all of a sudden you see that there is a human being who hasn't really been alive, and now they're alive. And this
is very interesting to me, just because of something Eric said and that you said about the biggest problem when people have like the bad trip is that there's too many questions, right? You mm-hmm. said it gets too big, it gets beyond them. And what's so interesting is when someone has a trauma happen, right? What happens? They question reality. They've had something happen that messed them all up, right? That wasn't supposed to be possible, but it did, and now they don't trust. So it's almost like the psychedelic experience is like homeopathic to trauma, because it causes them to question reality. They find out, oh, wait, this is not what I thought it was. And wait, who am I? And wait, what is all this stuff? So it almost like, to me, when you say like you see these people with the psychiatric problems specifically and how it has that effect, I mean, what do you think about that thing about like causing the questions and being like too many questions? Like, do you see any continuity between them when they're sick? Like, do they have all those questions too when they come in, or it just gets like blown up by the psychedelics?
Yeah, I think especially with cancer, by the time we see people seeking out psilocybin, which is the numbers on cancer patients who participate in clinical trials are really, really low to begin with. Most people are excluded because they're on other sorts of medications or treatments. And then psilocybin is already, you know, so way far away from what most oncologists would ever recommend that by the time we see people, I think they've already gone through a lot of that questioning. And they have run straight up into their biggest fears, their biggest obstacles. A lot of people that we see know that they're going to die very soon, or if they don't know, they fear it and they see it kind of coming in the future.
Right.
And then they have a lot of, you know, just basic things about their life, their work, their family that, you know, it's kind of like, how do you get up every morning and do the mundane things when you know you're going to die? Well, that's a big question for all of us, but I think people with cancer have already kind of hit that question. By the time they end up with us in psilocybin sessions, they're ready for the bigger questions. So it almost may be that the cancer patients do better than the healthy volunteers because they've already been kind of put through the ringer. A lot of people have already gone through chemo. They've already been completely broken down physically. And now they're still sitting here saying, well, I'm still alive. Now what?
Right, right.
So that may be kind of where the difference between the healthy volunteers and the cancer patients.
Well, you raise a really, really interesting conundrum. This is something I've really been thinking about a lot in the kind of, one form of the thought is the following, is that if it can be shown that psychedelics greatly reduce the stress and depression and anxiety associated with imminent mortality or, you know, life-threatening medical situations, and that becomes accepted, then it's not clear to me how you could legitimately really divide that from the situation that we're all in.
And, I agree.
And so it's almost like a kind of back door, you know, this weird, like that's my hope for the back door on legalization or decriminalization in this sort of context. But so that's my little hope out there, and I'd like to hear you talk about that. But particularly, you know, I invite you to talk about your own personal relationship with these questions around death and how we act in the world in the face of it, because I know that some of these we've been talking about the studies and how it affects other people, but these are all questions that have been very important to you personally as well. And, you know, we've had conversations other times about death and how people think about it and how it weaves into these questions of meaning and people's lives. So I'm kind of curious about how you started to see, even with the non-terminal patients, just how some of these questions around mortality started to, you know, be in the room, whether for the patients, but also for you.
Yeah. It's such an interesting process. I'll use the term guiding, but for people who aren't really familiar, what we do in sessions is more like midwifing people through. So we're not telling them what to experience or suggesting to do one thing at a certain time and then an hour later something else. But we do provide a really intense and intimate presence for people, and we hold space during sessions. So it is, guiding is a close enough term, but that's kind of what I mean when I say it. We're just holding space and helping people through and kind of making it through the whole arc of the session. So as you do that with people, you dive into someone else's life as intimately as you have probably dove into your own life at different times. And for that whole period of time during the session, you get to see what it's really like for the other person to be in their mind. And in the kind of classic contemplative traditions, the Buddha called it mind embracing mind. And so teachers, gurus, fellow practitioners will do this in community to help each individual kind of through the process. And what you end up finding is that as you are providing help for someone else, they are actually teaching you. And it's just kind of this mutual thing that's continuously happening. And so a really cool thing started happening with me when I had been guiding sessions for maybe a year or so. A lot of my volunteers started experiencing this kind of death rebirth process. And we had prepared all of our volunteers, you may feel like you're dying, go ahead and die. We're going to make sure your physical body is taken care of, you're safe, in and through. So these are all the kind of recommendations we give people. And then I started seeing it a lot, and I had young volunteers, some of whom were completely healthy, no real trauma in their life, some of whom who had lost siblings or friends to tragic accidents. But you couldn't really predict, based on their background, why these volunteers were experiencing their own death. And it really started to kind of throw it back to me, like, hey, like, I'm like these people. I'm young. I'm healthy. I'm not really looking at any major tragedies. So it kind of forced me to bring death a little bit closer into my own meditation practice. And then some really wild stuff happened to me that before that I couldn't have. If someone said, oh, meditation can be just like psychedelics, I'd say, yeah, that's a really cute way of phrasing it, but no, psychedelics are way different. And then something happened to me in meditation that was the most psychedelic experience I've ever had. And it was basically a death experience where everything was gone. including me. And it sounds like a really wild thing to have happen, and then you are back and you're kind of excited to still be alive. But instead, for me, it was actually quite terrifying. And I was back, but it really completely ripped the ground of reality out from under me.
How long did that, was it a half an hour session or something that extended over a long period, or were you were in a retreat?
This is conveniently in the middle of a conference that I was attending out in Tucson, Arizona. I had had this really interesting exchange with a Zen teacher who was there talking about his experience volunteering for other neuroscience studies around the country as a long-term practitioner. And it was kind of like a perfect storm of meeting a teacher, having these questions very ripe in my mind of working with our volunteers back at Hopkins, and I think being at a pretty stressful point in my career. And it was just kind of this 10-minute meditation on a rock by a waterfall. And from the outside, I don't think anyone could have known that basically the world exploded for me, but it did. And it was just this
Could you describe just really quick, like, what does that mean? Everything was just gone? Like, there was nothing? Just, like, to be a little more specific.
Yeah. You know, it's... These experiences are so funny when you try to put them into English. I sat down on the rock, and it was a beautiful morning, and I thought, oh, I'm just going to focus on my breath, maybe get a little bit more calm. I had kind of skipped the morning talks that morning. And as I closed my eyes, it would be more explicable if someone had, like, kind of jumped out of the cacti and, like, injected me with DMT. And what I mean by that is there was this very intense energy that was all of a sudden completely throughout my body and penetrating the space around me. And then I was seeing lots of colors, and I started to lose a sense of my body being different from the world around me. And then this question came up. I don't know where the question came from. It said, where am I? And as soon as the question was asked, it felt like everything became this swirling void of energy and chaos, where I wasn't really there. The world wasn't there. It was just kind of this one big chaotic maelstrom of energy.
Wow.
And the only thing I really remember from like an egocentric point of view was my heart was racing, and I felt my lower back pressed against the rock behind me. Which is funny, you'd think that would be enough to orient to, like, yes, I'm here. But in that space, for some reason, it wasn't me. And then I don't know really how long that lasted. It felt like it lasted forever. And then all of a sudden, I was clearly back in my body. And I remember kind of touching my legs and looking around and being like, wow, it's here. I'm back. Like, everything isn't a void. I was really happy. But completely unexpected. Like, completely unexpected that I sat down and had that experience at that moment.
That's remarkable stuff. This is, and no doubt, I can only imagine this brought up some questions for you about life and things. But we're going to get to those after the break, because we've got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Catherine McLean, and we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Daou, and we're here talking with Eric Davis and our guest, Catherine McLean, about psychedelics and scientifically investigating some of their uses. And Catherine, before the break, you were talking a little bit about your own experience with meditation, with no drugs at all, and how that kind of mimicked a psychedelic experience, which takes me to, I mean, there's a couple of things that brings up, of course, but it all goes back to the mind. So in researching medicine, I know you're talking about some of the results that psilocybin would have on cancer patients trying to deal with fear and mortality and facing all of those things, but on like a higher kind of psychiatric level in general, which of course is how like LSD kind of got started looking at. I wonder, I know you said there were like some depressed people and some anxiety people, but that you guys shied away and were conservative with treating people with histories of mental problems. But my question is, there's no treatment for mental illness and most of those problems. So my question is, if we're finding, if some of these psilocybin things are finding that it actually, I mean, even though you can have like a terrible, horrifying experience with it, or it'll like make you feel cool about any terror you can kind of face, do you feel like in what you've seen, do you think it could have like application to things like schizophrenia, or do you feel like it would just like exacerbate it or make it worse, or is it just like too difficult to tell?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think it's kind of territory that most scientists and clinicians are scared to be the first ones to go back into. And back in the day, in the 50s, LSD was being tried with pretty much every patient who was in a mental hospital.
Right.
People didn't really understand how it worked, but they kind of understood that it sometimes mimicked spiritual experiences. Sometimes it made people have access to their whole mind in a way that they could solve problems better. And then it was tried out with people with schizophrenia and psychosis. I think most of those attempts didn't go so well. I think the psychedelics usually exacerbated the really negative aspects of schizophrenia, increasing the paranoia, increasing the delusional thoughts. I might argue that it would be potentially a better application of the medicine for psychiatrists and clinicians to experience their own psychedelic session, that might actually increase the empathy and ability to resonate with patients who themselves have a very fluid sense of what's real and what's not. And that was, it's not my idea, but it would be a new idea, I think, right now, to use psychedelics as part of training for either people who are going into mental health professions or are dealing with crisis situations or are going into palliative care work. I think, was it at NYU? There was a number of clinicians who were actually trained back in the day with LSD to help them give them insight into the psychiatric process. And
it's very funny because that's, of course, what shamans do, right? I know now, like, everyone goes to Peru and takes ayahuasca with the shamans, but actually, traditionally, it was the shaman that would take
this up.
They wouldn't give it to their patients, right? The shaman takes it, and then they heal you. So it's very interesting that that's a strategy they're trying to implement.
And I think the other important point about how these medicines are used now is they are really melded together with a very strong interpersonal connection and rapport and trust with the guides. And so it hasn't happened very often, but we have called off sessions with volunteers whom we were not able to establish trust with. So spend about 8 to 10 hours, maybe it's about 6 to 10 hours with healthy volunteers before the first session, going over their whole life and their biggest fears, hopes, dreams, the things they really care about, the things they want to work on in the session. And if we don't feel that they trust us by the time that we begin the session, we will call it off. And the most important thing is that we can establish that understanding that we are there to literally take care of their life for them for that whole day. And so that might be the piece that's actually the hardest with psychiatric patients. If you start talking about schizophrenia or, you know, bipolar disorder with psychotic elements, or borderline is one of the trickiest out there, it's hard to establish that authentic sense of trust that literally you are giving someone your life for a day to take care of, and then they will give it back to you.
That's fascinating. I'm curious that another sort of maybe slightly personal question was that there were different guides for the Hopkins study. So you were doing some patients. There were other people or individuals who were kind of leading other patients. Was there any noticeable relationship between who was leading the session and the quality of the sessions? You know, that with one guide, sessions tended to be more this way, and with another guide, they tended to be more that way. I mean, I know you didn't have tons of data, but were there any suggestions that the sort of setting of the guide partly shapes the experience?
Yeah, that's such a great, I mean, I think that that's going to be one of the most interesting questions to answer as we go forward. And right now, as you said, we don't have enough data to make really strong conclusions. But the one piece of data that I can, actually there are kind of two pieces. The first piece is I looked across all of the sessions that were run, high-dose sessions across all of the guides, and there's this one item on our questionnaires that we ask at the end of the day that refers to an experience of universal and infinite love. And the good news is all of the guides, all of the volunteers, it's pretty much like 90% endorse that question. So we've got that piece figured out, and maybe that's where the psilocybin is just the strongest litmus test. It's a really powerful drug for occasioning this appreciation and love that is unconditional. And that's at the end of the session. So it may not have been at every point in the session you were feeling the love, but by the end, most people are there. Related to the death question, I had seen this so much in sessions, this people encountering their own mortality and experiencing death and sometimes this kind of feeling of being reborn. And so I started looking at the data, and the numbers were way too low. It was something like 30% of volunteers had endorsed the item that said, I had a profound experience of my own death. And I said, well, that doesn't make sense. It's more than 30%. And then I looked at my volunteers, and it was something like 70 or 80. So that was kind of a piece of the wake-up call for me, that it wasn't necessarily the psilocybin per se that helps people encounter death, but it has a lot to do with what the guide brings into the room. And I've actually had a number of lighthearted and humorous interactions with some of our volunteers who did experience that. And when I kind of shared this little piece with them, they were like, oh, thanks, great. Like, I lucked out and I got the death trip. But I think a lot of them really value it. You know, it wasn't something that I intended. But it's something that kind of came out of that really cool dynamic process of, you know, death is a big part of most contemplative traditions, and some might say in Buddhism it's the only part. And that was kind of coming through in perhaps how I prepared people, the questions that they asked me and how I answered them before the session, and then the kind of space that you create. If you actually establish that trust, then people can go anywhere. They can go through their own death. They can feel like they're losing their mind, and they actually trust you to somehow return it to them by the end of the day, which is really cool. It's like a really nice agreement, you know? It's like we're creating the safe space, and they're actually saying, I will go anywhere for you. I will be the explorer, and you just have to kind of make sure that I get back into this body by the end of the day because I got stuff to do tomorrow.
Yeah, it's remarkable because, I mean, it brings up, to my mind, of course, I start thinking about, you know, the role of spiritual teachers in people's lives and the great masters and the ascended, you know, the gurus or whatever. But in a way, this particular situation is one where, you know, you have your experiences, you've gone through, you got a psychology PhD, you have a lot of intentionality, you've done some meditation, but you're not like, you know, some hi-hat guru. And yet within that structure, a really profound thing can happen that requires two, you know, and requires someone to be holding the space down and to be kind of agreeing to that larger intentionality, and someone else to be willing to go through a process where they're not in control of the situation. And it can be, you know, it's really quite heartening to me when I think about the future of this kind of research. But I also know that, you know, you're not currently working at Johns Hopkins. Here you were, you know, studying these two hotly trending topics in psychology. You're at a major research at university doing major research, you know, fascinating work, getting results, amazing stuff. But you, for your own reasons, have stepped away for that, at least temporarily. I can only imagine that has something to do with some of these questions that were raised for you and think, you know, things that you had to do that. I'd love to invite you to touch on some of that, like what were those questions that led you to step away, at least temporarily, from this, you know, very kind of successful professional line that you were on?
Yeah, you know, it's so interesting when you realize that the life that you think that you're leading is leading you somewhere, but you actually have no idea where that is. And I think for a long time, especially in the realm of science, you kind of, I felt like I was in control. I was making choices. I was deciding to go here or there, pursue this or that. And then this whole encounter with literally this groundless reality, this void in meditation, made me kind of realize that maybe all of this is completely out of my control. And it kind of sent me on this path of delving deeper into this question of who am I and where am I. I was working with a teacher. I ended up doing a Zen retreat with Roshi Joan Halifax out in New Mexico. And shortly after this whole 6-7 month process that was really like a slow death for me, a death of some kind of identity that I'd held on to for a really long time, who felt like she was in control. So after this whole long, kind of tedious dying off process, I returned home from the retreat. This was about a year ago. And my younger sister was being rushed to the hospital with shortness of breath. She had had breast cancer a few years earlier, but was in really good health at the time. And the cancer metastasized to stage 4 very suddenly, very aggressively, and she died 6 weeks later. And all of a sudden, that whole slow dying process that I had experienced in meditation and what I had seen so many people go through in sessions before became really real, really fast. And the thing that I witnessed with my sister was, and I don't mean to trivialize the actual bodily dying process, but there were so many levels at which it was indistinguishable from psychedelic sessions. And I felt like all of the training that I had received at Hopkins was being put to use for the safe passage of someone who I cared deeply about. And not only that, I was kind of the only person in the room who had that training, including the doctors, including the palliative care physicians who were excellent, but there was this piece that was missing, this kind of midwifing people through the death process that is just kind of too uncomfortable and scary for most people to want to spend much time with. And once I had gone through that process, then you kind of come out of it and you're like, okay, now what? I just did the most important thing I've ever done in my life. And, like, well, I'm still here. It's kind of the question with the cancer patients. You know, I've just gone through this horrific pain and this whole transition, and but I'm still standing. I'm still here. So what do I do? And shortly after my sister died, this kind of thing popped into my head, like, I'm going to take a year off. And, of course, it was this completely unplanned thing, but it felt right. And then I decided to go to Nepal with the same woman who ran the retreat in New Mexico. And Joan Halifax, kind of cycling all the way back, was married to Stan Grof and doing work with LSD and death and dying back in the early 70s. And then she kind of left that work, became a very well-known medical anthropologist traveling the world, and then about the age of 50 became a Zen priest. And she's been going to Nepal for about 30 years. So I joked with Joan, I said, you know, it's like we kind of have a lot of overlap in our paths, and I don't know what the first step is for this year off, but Nepal with you seems like a pretty good start. And so we kind of laughed about that, and Nepal was a pilgrimage. And that piece is still, I think, completely framing the last 2 years of my life experience since I sat and meditated by that waterfall. And the interesting thing about pilgrimage is it's often a circle. It's kind of a microcosm so that you can reflect on the whole big picture. And the really nice thing about doing it for real and going to a foreign country and walking the whole way is it feels a little bit more substantial than taking a psychedelic journey where you don't really get to share it with anyone else. It's just always kind of for you and your mind. So that's it in a nutshell, and I just got back from Nepal about a month and a half ago, and the journey continues. And right now it's continuing.
I have a question for you, because I see this a lot in so many of my clients and so many people that have had a death experience like you talk about. Is, I call it the Frodo Baggins syndrome, right, from Lord of the Rings. It's like Frodo goes and he goes to Mordor, right? He goes to this terrible volcano. He sees all this death. He has to deal with the grips. He has a transformational experience, right? Then he goes back to the Shire. He goes back home, but he can't, like, talk to people. He can't, like, hang out. He's like, tries to go back and think everything's cool, but he's not able to accomplish this. He has to leave his home and go with the elves to go on, you know, like, become a wandering sadhu, kind of go with the elves and go off to the land and whatever. So I was wondering if, in your experience, and this is true of, like, people that have trauma, too, like veterans, they come back from the war, they can't hang anymore. Now they're different. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you had a similar experience where, even, like, now, getting back from Nepal, do you feel like you can, like, reintegrate? Is that going to be capable? Because I always think about, like, how do you get the Frodo Baggins, the veterans, the people like you that have experienced this, how do we get back in and talk with regular people? Right.
Yeah, it's that whole topic and the piece of integration is so relevant for me, and it's so true that it is tough and it's a slow process. And sometimes I feel when I'm in the midst of, like, a personally difficult reintegration, much as the last 6 weeks have been, I keep reminding myself that I'm lucky that I'm actually in the position of helping others in the future, because every time I go through something that's really confusing and painful, it's helping me understand what that is like for someone else.
Right.
And I would say I think we've got a long way to go with figuring out how to help people integrate. I think the biggest piece is it takes a lot of time, whether it's coming back from the death of a loved one or coming back from a pilgrimage or coming back from something that's very traumatic, like war. The biggest piece is time and creating safe spaces for people to take the time to be with their experience as they come back into the world.
Yeah, I think one of the problems that we have now is that even when people have extraordinary experiences that have the potential for being very transformative but require that time, is that the nature of our lives today they're so busy and they're so full of distraction and they're so full of external demands that seem very important, but kind of, you know, it's very easy to lose one's way. That, and in fact, even worse than that, is that living in our society with constant change and constant, like, oversaturation of information and density, is that we're very used to absorbing a certain kind of shock to the system. It's like, bam, we get hit with something. We're like, ah, whatever, you just go on, keep on working. And so that it's very, some of these really powerful experiences, which are shocks on as well as other things, it's almost easy to go, oh yeah, that was a crazy thing, wow, okay, here we go, and you just, you know, you dive right back in, and that whole quality of time that you're talking about, that just even the way you're describing it, it's really coming through, the sense of needing space and time and integration and a kind of slowness and a kind of willingness to be in your not knowing. It's very hard to create, you know, in our lives today.
And I feel very thankful that when my sister went in the hospital and coming back from Nepal, I didn't have anything that I needed to return to, and I had the luxury of a job that gave me that space. Talk about the 1%. I mean, that kind of luxury is not enjoyed by many people, especially people who've come out of traumatic situations or caring for a loved one who has died. And I'm not sure what it's going to take in terms of resources, both money and human resources, to provide that space for people. But one of the ways that I feel like paying forward my experiences with my sister and the work at Hopkins and my experiences in Nepal is to kind of dedicate myself to creating these kind of spaces and resources for people. And, you know, the psychedelic medicine is one tool. But the funny thing is, when you get into the middle of a crisis situation, like death, like trauma, like being in the wilderness, all of a sudden you don't really need the psychedelics, because the present moment becomes completely psychedelic.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of a combination of helping people maybe understand what those situations are like through psychedelics or meditation beforehand, and then providing the safe therapeutic space for everyday people who've gone through it and then kind of wake up and realize, like, what just happened to me? This is very non-ordinary.
Yeah.
And
well, you know, that's a wonderful vision, and I'm afraid we're going to have to end it on that. Thanks so much for this conversation. It was really, really meaningful and interesting to me. And best of luck as you navigate through the field of possibilities.
Thank you so much. It was such a great opportunity, and I really enjoyed talking to you guys this afternoon.
Wonderful. Okay. Well, from Maja and me to all you out there, keep your minds open.